This podcast is supported by the Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai, one of America's leading medical research schools. How will advances in artificial intelligence transform medical research and medical care? To find out, we invite you to read a special supplement to Science Magazine prepared by Icon Mount Sinai in partnership with Science. Just visit our website at science.org and search for Frontiers of Medical Research-Artificial Intelligence. On May 1st and May 2nd, Icon Mount Sinai and the New York Academy of Sciences will be convening a major symposium in New York City on the new wave of AI in healthcare. For more information and to register, please visit events.nyas.org/AI Health. That's events.nyas.org/AI Health. The Icon School of Medicine at Mount Sinai. We find a way. This week's episode is brought to you in part by the NOMIS and Science Young Explorer Award. Are you doing excellent research that deserves recognition? The NOMIS and Science Young Explorer Award recognizes bold young researchers who ask fundamental questions at the intersection of the life and social sciences. Researchers who take risks to address relevant and exciting questions with creative approaches, regardless of the research outcome. Submissions are due May 15th. Visit science.org/NOMIS, that's N-O-M-I-S, to apply today. Welcome to the Science Podcast for March 3rd, 2017. I'm Sarah Crespi. In this week's show, Carolina Levis joins Alexa Billow to talk about when exactly humans started managing plants in the Amazon. And Catherine Matisik is here with a roundup of stories from the Daily News site.
Support for the Science Podcast comes from AAAS, the American Association for the Advancement of Science, and its members. Join them in serving science and society at www.aaas.org.
Now we have Catherine Matisik, an editor for our daily news site. She's here to talk about some recent online stories. First up, we have a story on breaking the two-hour marathon barrier. I have to admit, I went into this, you know, reading this story, not knowing how long, even ballpark, it might take to run a marathon. I saw 2 hours in the headline, and that blew my mind. And then, we're talking about 42 kilometers, 26 miles.
Actually, 26.2.
Yeah, exactly. If you've seen the bumper sticker, you know that. But then my mind was even further blown when I realized that the fastest runners are only minutes off from breaking this 2-hour limit. Okay, so bypassing my amazement at all of this, what's the science angle here? I mean, what does science have to offer marathoners?
Sarah, that is like asking what God has to do with religion. Any good runner, and I admit I am not one of those, will tell you that running is a science. Physiologists break it down three ways: how much power you can produce, how efficiently you can use that power, and how hard your course is or how difficult it is.
Let's take power first. How could runners gain more power?
Legitimately?
Yes.
Illegitimately.
Okay. Let's start with illegitimately.
Oh, well, I was going to start with legitimately and then go into the fun stuff.
Okay.
All right. So we'll do that. So power is measured in something called VO2 max, the maximum volume of oxygen that your body can use in a minute relative to your body weight. Elite marathon runners, and here we're talking about people like Kenya's Dennis Kimeto, who holds the world record at 2 hours, 2 minutes, and 57 seconds. These runners use around 80% of maximum during a race. But if you're an every other weekend warrior like me, you've probably got a lot of room for improvement. You can improve power by training at high intensity over long periods of time. But the ceiling for this VO2 max is determined mostly by genetics. So at a certain point, you hit a ceiling, leading us to the other route. Illegitimate.
Okay.
Increases in power. I'm sure you can guess where we're going here. Doping, using drugs like erythropoietin, which can jack up hemoglobin levels and thus boost oxygen transport in the blood. But that's a practice frowned upon, putting it mildly, by many runners and running organizations.
Okay, so that's power. And then what about efficiency? That's another thing that researchers are looking into improving.
Good question. It entails everything from how effectively you stride to how you breathe. Even crossing your arms in front of your chest, for example, is a waste of power that you could otherwise be harnessing to propel yourself forward. Just a pro tip there. When it comes to your legs, only about 45% of the power that they generate actually pushes you forward. The rest dissipates when your foot strikes the ground. So to increase efficiency, runners can improve their form. They can also stay well hydrated. But they can also use all sorts of fancy equipment meant to return energy back to the legs.
This is the shoe story, right?
By equipment, I pretty much mean shoes, because that's all you got. Some scientists think that spring-loaded footwear could be the key, improving efficiency by as much as 1% to 2%, with 2% kind of being the goal to break through this two-hour barrier. One running shoe company that will not be named recently applied for just such a patent, and others have recently marketed special springy foam that they claim could have similar results. But a lot of trainers are skeptical that technology alone is going to do the trick.
This next way of improving marathon times, it seems a little hinky to me, and that's making the course easier. For example, having the whole thing be downhill. Is that even fair? Is that something that would be considered record-breaking if it happened?
Well, I mean, I guess the first question, of course, is what do you consider fair? if you are going for a record, you're right, having an all-downhill course, preferably with a strong wind at your back, you know, that would be ideal. And actually running below sea level would also help a lot because oxygen concentration in the atmosphere increases as your altitude decreases. But the downside is something you also hit on the head, which is that international organizations like the International Association of Athletics Federations might not want to certify a record-setting run set under those circumstances.
Right.
You know, Nike has recently made a pledge to break the two-hour barrier sometime this year, but even they admitted that their time would probably not be eligible for the record.
Okay. How feasible is this really, looking at all these different methods that we've talked about? It is a small change, but people have really been optimizing their running times for decades.
To put things in perspective, elite male runners have been racing under 2:15 for almost 50 years. Mm. And it took the last 15 years to get from 2 hours and 5 minutes to about 2 hours and 3 minutes, which is roughly a 2% boost in performance. It isn't impossible to think that it can't happen again, but it will take many small steps and not one giant leap to break the two-hour barrier.
Now we have a story on a different kind of record breaking. DNA's job is to store information, how to build proteins, how to coil itself, all kinds of things useful for cellular life. But what about other forms of data, things that maybe won't help a cell out, like a book or an operating system? Catherine, why might we want to store this type of data in a DNA format?
Well, DNA has all sorts of advantages. It's ultra-compact, and it can last hundreds of thousands of years if it's kept in a cool, dry place, as we've seen from many of our recent excavations of fossilized DNA. It doesn't degrade over time like cassette tapes and CDs, and it's also unlikely to become obsolete, at least while we're still around.
Right.
So that means that as human societies are reading and writing DNA, they'll be able to continue to decode it. And unlike other high-density approaches, new technologies can write and read large amounts of DNA at a time, allowing it to possibly be scaled up.
And this new approach we're going to talk about today looks at increasing the information density in DNA encoding. What was the record before today's study, and what are they shooting for? What's the ultimate goal here?
So the first time people used DNA to encode data was in 2012, when Harvard University geneticists George Church and Sri Kosuri encoded a 52,000-word book in thousands of snippets of DNA. It worked, but it was a little bit inefficient. It meant that they could store only 5.5 petabytes per gram of DNA. Since then, other approaches have done better, but none has been able to store more than half of what researchers think DNA can actually handle. And this was your question about what's the main goal. Mm-hmm. So their maximum capacity in theory is about 1.8 bits of data per DNA nucleotide. The new system is the highest density, large-scale data storage scheme ever invented, capable of storing 215 petabytes in a single gram of DNA. At that density, every bit of data ever recorded by humans could fit into a container about the size and weight of a couple of pickup trucks.
Hmm. Okay, can you tell us in a very general sense how these researchers encode, print, and then read out the data from the DNA?
I am so glad we're going general on this one. In short, scientists convert files. In this most recent case, this included a full computer operating system and a French film that was made in 1895 into binary strings of ones and zeros. They then compress that data into one master file and split it into short strings of binary code. They used an algorithm, in this case something called a DNA fountain, to randomly package the strings into so-called droplets, to which they added these little extra tags that help researchers reassemble the data later in the proper order. They then mapped the ones and zeros in each droplet to the four bases of DNA, A, G, C, and T. Once this process is complete, an outside company synthesizes the DNA, and about 2 weeks later, the researchers get it back and decode the physical DNA using commercial sequencers.
Okay, so using molecular biology techniques seems kind of like a slow way to store and retrieve data. I mean, you still have to kind of go through all these steps to get it in there and to get it out. Is that a problem for using this approach in any kind of everyday way?
Well, the new data storage isn't ready for prime time just yet. There are a couple of reasons for that, one of them being speed and another cost. In terms of cost, it cost researchers $7,000 to synthesize the 2 megabytes of data in their files and another $2,000 to read it back. You know, so that is a little bit more expensive than your average floppy drive, which dates me, I think. But then, you know, that cost is likely to come down over time. But compared to other forms of data storage, writing and reading to DNA, that actual process is relatively slow. So while the new approach could work as an archival system, for example, it's probably not likely to work in the near term if the data is needed instantly. But then again, who knows? Maybe those giant Facebook and Amazon data centers will someday be replaced by a couple of pickup trucks.
Last up, we have a story on zigzagging backbones in dinosaurs. We're going to be talking about the backbones of some very big dinos, sauropods, which can reach up to 77 tons and 50 meters in length, 15 of those meters being neck. Okay, so scientists have tried for a long time to figure out what these beasts did, how they adapted to carrying all this weight around. What are some of the things we know they had to do in order to pack on the pounds like this?
Well, scientists and school children everywhere have long asked that very same question, because the larger the body, the harder it is to support, especially, as you said, when much of that weight is hovering in the air. You know, I think one estimate says as much as 2/3 of the body weight of some of these sauropods could be in the neck and in the tail. That's crazy. And so over the years, scientists have discovered many adaptations that help these dinos carry their massive weight. For example, they had weight-bearing pillar-like legs, small heads with fewer muscles in the jaw, which meant that the head was lighter and easier to support, but at the same time, they had to swallow their food whole. And they also had bones that were peppered with air sacs.
Hmm. For this story, we need to understand what vertebrae look like and how they form. Can you paint us a word picture, Catherine?
Only if I get 1,000 words. Just kidding.
Yeah, okay.
But it's an interesting setup, and it took me a while to understand it. Basically, when you and I and all sorts of other mammals grow, a lot of that early growth happens in our backbones. The same is true for dinosaurs. So each vertebra is made of two bones that slowly fuse over time. the main cylindrical bone called the centrum, and then an arc of bone that houses the spinal cord called the neural arch. The two bones wrap around the spinal cord like a padlock, touching once they come together. Exactly when they start to fuse depends on the animal. In humans, that happens around the age of 6 or 7. But in the giant sauropods, the ones that we're talking about, fusion didn't finish until they were well into their 20s, when they were almost fully grown.
So when researchers looked at the fossilized bones of one of these giant dinosaurs, they saw something unusual in their vertebrae where this meeting takes place. What did they see?
So at that joint between the two parts of the backbone, they noticed something unusual. It's usually smooth. Think of like a sneaker with no treads. But in the fossilized vertebra of one dinosaur, there was this crazy zigzaggy line where the two bones came together. To researchers, it looked like the joint wasn't smooth as it is in humans, but toothed and grooved. So just imagine what that would mean if a young dinosaur were suddenly injured. Instead of sliding and snapping, the two bones could clamp together around the spinal cord, protecting it from major injury.
Was this grooving, or were these grooves present on all of the parts of the spine?
So they were present in most parts, but what was interesting was that some spots were more complex or zigzaggy than others. The simplest joints are near the head, and the most complex are in the bones behind the shoulders, where stress was probably the highest. And this makes sense if you think about, you know, the purpose of these bones being to help this dinosaur support weight. It would have allowed the dinosaur to better support more weight the further down the neck you go.
How common do they think this adaptation is? Is it something we're going to see in many, many types of dinosaurs?
We might. Researchers aren't yet sure, simply because they haven't been looking for this before. But it is possible that other weighty dinosaurs, like the 9-ton Tyrannosaurus Rex, could sport similar toothed grooves. If they do, it's going to help paleontologists better understand how these animals lived and, importantly, how they handled stress.
All right. What else is on the site this week, Catherine?
We have a story on how pandas got their patches, and another on a new contender for the oldest evidence of life on Earth. On Science Insider, our policy blog, we have a breakdown of what proposed budget cuts might mean for the U.S. EPA, and an update on which science societies have endorsed April's March for Science.
Thanks, Catherine.
Thanks, Sarah.
Catherine Matisik is an editor for our online daily news site. I'm Sarah Crespi.
We tend to think of human influence on the Amazon basin as a bad thing, the destruction of an untouched plant paradise. New research shows it's actually been managed by humans for millennia. As part of a massive effort across the Amazon, Carolina Levis shows that plants domesticated by pre-Columbian peoples prevail throughout the region. I'm Alexa Billow. Carolina, thanks for being here today.
Hi, Alexa. Thanks for having me today.
So what species of plants are we talking about? Anything we would recognize? Anything familiar to us?
So we study 85 species of trees and palms with populations incipiently semi or fully domesticated by past indigenous societies in Amazonia. And we can say that 20 of these 85 domesticated species, and we found that these species are widespread across the basin. They are widely recognized, like acai palm, cocoa tree, Brazil nut tree.
So we might have indigenous peoples in part to thank for the widespread availability of chocolate then.
Yeah, exactly. Chocolate is a very good example because it's native of Western Amazon, and it was taken to Central America by pre-Columbian populations, and they really created the chocolate that we know today.
What did people do to manage these plants? How do they spread?
They kind of domesticated forest landscape to really improve their food production. So they did several management practices. I can say that they planted seeds. They protected these useful plants that they planted before. The time frame of these activities is, I can say, a long time ago, because humans started to plant and domesticate plants in the Amazon more than 8,000 years ago.
Is domesticating plants anything like domesticating animals? How can you look at a plant and tell that it has been domesticated?
Domesticating plants and animals involves a very similar process. In our study, we searched for evidences, especially of selection and propagation by humans in the past. So the first thing that we looked for is if we can find morphological differences between cultivated and wild populations of plants. Like the size of the useful parts usually increases when humans domesticate plants. And the genetic difference between cultivated and wild populations is another indication. The thing is that we studied trees and palms managed within forests. So these changes are not so dramatic.
But you could still spot them by looking for things like larger useful parts and their genetics.
Exactly.
It just wasn't as drastic.
Yeah, exactly. It was not so strong. It's like the changes was not so drastic, but we can see some changes.
So the data in your study suggest that archaeological sites are a good place to find domesticated species of plants. You also suggest that the relationship could be predictive the other way around, that if you identify the presence of these domesticated plants, that could point to archaeological sites that haven't been excavated yet. Can you tell us a little more about that and what you might hope to find with such a method?
And nowadays, most of the Amazon basin is covered by forests. In many archaeological artifacts like ceramics and structures like mounds are hidden in the forest, so they are very difficult to find. And domesticated plants are more visible, and maybe they can point to archaeological sites within the forest. Our study shows that domesticated plant abundance can be a kind of useful tool to search for archaeological sites within the forest.
So basically, it's easier to spot the plants in the jungle or these densely forested places than it is to spot the mounds or places that have not been used for a long time.
Exactly, because it's easy to see trees than to see, for example, ceramics that are hidden on the soils.
What does this mean for the idea of the Amazon as this untouched wilderness? What about the impact of pre-industrial societies on their environments?
Oh, I think our study challenges the view of many ecologists and conservationists because our study confirms that even areas of the Amazon that may seem as pristine today are crowded with ancient footprints. And the impact of pesticides in the vegetation was higher. We saw that in the proximity of their settlements of past humans. For example, they use different forms of food production than modern society used today because they transformed pristine forests in domesticated forests. They didn't transform forests into monocultures of annual crops like the ones we have in the southern border of the Amazon. Soybean plantations are taking space everywhere. With past activities, they didn't lead to widespread deforestation because usually indigenous people like diversity. I see this study and this kind of systems as an opportunity to reduce deforestation. And maybe it can be used as an alternative way of food production while maintaining the forest as it is.
So even though the forest has been managed by humans for a very long time, it was managed by the indigenous peoples in a much more sustainable fashion.
Yeah, we actually don't know exactly what they did, but we can see today that in places where they manage the forest, the diversity of usable plants is high.
So what does this mean for trying to restore forested areas that have been depleted or trying to conserve forested areas? Can we restore them to some natural state when human fingerprints have been on them for a very, very long time?
This is a very interesting question to me. I can rephrase in a different way, like how did the forest look like before humans arrived more than 10,000 years ago? I can say that when humans arrived, the forest was very different. And through our study, we showed that they changed the abundance and distribution of domesticated species. So restoring this forest to a natural state would be reducing the distribution and abundance of these domesticated species. But if we think and we look at the Amazon today, millions of people live there. And most of the rural communities, they depend completely on these forest products for their well-being. So instead of thinking of the Amazon as a pristine forest, we need to learn how to manage this forest today, considering that the Amazon forest is a dynamic socio-ecological system.
It's very, very complex and very interesting. Carolina, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks, Alecta. It was a very pleasure to discuss with you our discovery.
Carolina Levis and colleagues publish an article about domesticated plants in the Amazon in this week's issue of Science.
And that concludes this edition of the Science Podcast. If you have any comments or suggestions for the show, write us at sciencepodcast@aaas.org or tweet to us at Science Magazine. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Stitcher, and many other apps, or listen to us on the Science site. The show is a production of Science Magazine. Jeffrey Cook composed the music. I'm Sarah Crespi, on behalf of Science Magazine and its publisher, AAAS. Thanks for joining us. This week's episode is brought to you in part by Science Careers. Looking for some career advice? Wondering how to get ahead or how to strike a better work-life balance? Visit our site to read how others are doing it. Use our individual development plan tool, access topic-specific article collections, or search for an exciting new job. Science Careers, produced by Science and AAAS, is a free website full of resources to help get the most out of your career. Visit sciencecareers.org today to get started.